This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww.
People don't care as much about like chemicals and what they're exposed to, but I don't know, maybe I'm not in the right circles.
I think you need to spend more time on Twitter. Come down the rabbit hole with us.
Show about medicine.
Pending FDA approval.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're going to look at the evidence behind medical topics. And the show is...
Wait. No, I want to say it.
I want to say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
We are joined by Julie Robitaille, a PhD student in the laboratory of Professor Valérie Langlois and the president of the student committee of the Intersectoral Center for Endocrine Disruptors Analysis. Julie has worked on biological monitoring methods for endocrine disruptors in wastewater in our province of Quebec and is also knowledgeable about international regulation for endocrine disruptors in water. So welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for that nice introduction.
So, Julie, there's been a lot of news and noise and worries these past few years about certain chemicals in our environment and the effect that they may or may not have on human health and on our ecosystems. The category of chemicals that we wanted to discuss with you today is the endocrine disruptors. And specifically, we're going to use one particular example, which is a plasticizer known as bisphenol A or BPA.
Otherwise known as the devil's chemical.
Yeah, in some circles. So many of our listeners will have had to make a choice at some point, right? Do I seek out a product like a water bottle that is BPA-free for myself or my children? Is it really safer? Should I be worried about ingesting BPA? So we're going to delve into this world, and I'm very curious to know the state of our knowledge on endocrine disruptors. So first off, what is an endocrine disruptor, and what are some examples of specific molecules that act in this way and where they come from?
So, a really good question, and I guess a complex question also. So first of all, before talking about what are endocrine disruptors, I always like to start with what is the endocrine system, because that's a complicated word for a lot of people I've met. What is the endocrine system?
And almost more important, is it pronounced endocrine or endocrine? A debate Jonathan and I have almost with every episode about many different words in medicine.
I guess my first language is not English, so I guess that's up to you. Right. I'm not sure. But what is the endocrine system? Well, first, it's the system that... It's all the systems that include hormones. So what is a hormone also? That's another question. So a hormone is really a chemical messenger. So one gland will produce a hormone. It will travel through blood and get to a specific tissue or a cell and induce a response. So that's really complicated. So let's go with examples, I would say. So for example, estrogen that we'll probably talk a lot about today is a... sex steroids, mostly known for all female-related things. And so estrogen will be produced in the ovaries. Then it will travel through blood, through all the different organs that are related to female things. So, I don't know, the uterus, breast, ovaries, whatever you want, and then produce actions that are related to femininity. Yeah, so that's a hormone. I don't know if it's clear enough.
I think it's pretty clear. I mean, I think we often, the public especially, when they hear the word hormone, they tend to think sex hormone. But in fact, there's a lot of different things that are hormones in the body. Insulin is technically a hormone. There's a lot of chemical signals that regulate all the body processes. They don't have to necessarily be testosterone and estrogen, although I found that the colloquial discussion in the public sphere is often really, really centered on sex hormones, and they kind of forget all the other hormones in the body that are going about doing their business on a daily basis and don't seem to be bothering anyone.
Yeah, but I would say even in research, it's really biased towards everything related to reproduction. But of course, like you said, there's so many more hormones in the body. Like you mentioned, insulin and glucagon, the counterpart of insulin. You have also adrenaline, which many people don't think as a hormone. But yeah, you need that to live.
You need that to be alive.
To respond to high stress, yeah. Also there's a lot of other steroids hormones like glucocorticoids, mineralocorticoids, which are really important for a lot of other functions. There are thyroid hormones, melatonin for the sleep cycle. Hormones in your neural system that are really important, but there's so many that I don't think it's relevant to go in all of them today. But yeah, there's really a lot of hormones that control a lot of function in our bodies, and we tend to forget about them.
So that's hormones. When we talk about endocrine disruptors or endocrine disruptors, depending how you want to pronounce it, what specifically are we referring to? Because in one sense, it could mean anything that interferes with a hormone. But when we use that word, what are we actually referring to?
Like you said, kind of everything that can interact with hormones. The definition is really broad. Often when we talk about endocrine disruptors, most of the studies will look at if the hormone can interact with their receptor in a cell, but it can go all around the place through the synthesis, to the transport of the hormone, through their tissue of effect, and any kind of other effects that is maybe too complicated to talk today.
So what drew you to this field? Why did you decide to start studying this? When you were a grad student, why did you decide to do your PhD in this? And is there something about this field that has surprised you since you've been studying it?
I didn't decide that off the bat after my undergrad. Mm. In fact, during my undergrad, I'd looked more at fundamental biochemistry, so really far away from toxicology and endocrine disruptors. But I did a master in toxicology, general toxicology, which looked at kind of everything that can be toxic. And at some point, we had classes on endocrine disruptors, and I really thought they were interesting, but I guess in a complicated kind of way, yeah. because they kind of oppose the traditional toxicology dogma, I would say, and they confronted a lot of how we're doing things in toxicology. So I thought that was really interesting. And we still haven't found really a way to regulate them, probably, I would say. And I think that's an interesting problem to solve.
So let me ask you then, about plastic, because I'm curious to know if you have a particular stance on plastics, because the 20th century is probably going to be remembered as the century where we got really, really good at science when you consider what happened between the years 1900 and, 1900 and the year 2000. And plastics are everywhere. But as we take a closer look at our planet, we're starting to realize there's problems with these things. They're maybe not great for the environment. There's been a little bit of a pushback now from the general public that maybe chemistry has gone too far. We've created too many of these products. What do you think about plastic as a compound? Do you think there are harms to it? Do you think that it's been a net positive or a net negative for our society in terms of the many, many things that we use plastic for?
I think they're not on the toxicological side of things. I think plastic brought a lot of innovation, and we cannot deny that. For example, just in the medical field, I think we wouldn't have all the tubings and things that are really important, even for research also to go forward. But for sure, for consumption, in the way we're exposed to chemicals, it increased drastically what we're exposed to. And for sure, that's the bad side of it. And that's why we need to maybe rethink on how we want to use plastic. Is it useful all the time? Is there a better way to make plastic? There's so many questions I think we think about.
So coming back to endocrine disruptors, you know, I mentioned the plasticizer BPA. There's been a lot of worries about what these endocrine disruptors do to our body in the long term. What do we know about the negative effects of endocrine disruptors versus what do we suspect that they might do, but we lack high quality evidence, right? And is it a question of dosage, of how much we're exposed to them over how long of a period of time? What do we know? What do we suspect we know? What is the state of our knowledge here?
Wow, such a big question. I don't really know where to start.
Start with the nature of God and take it from there.
That doesn't help me. but maybe we could start with like the example you've given, BPA, bisphenol A, to start with, and then maybe we can go further than that.
Sounds good.
The problem is, so BPA, if you don't know, is used as like part of the production of polycarbonate, which polycarbonate is found kind of in so many products. You can think about water bottles, baby bottles, toys, plastic food container, plastic wraps, thermal paper. What else? The lining and cans also has some BPA in it. There's a lot of things that are made out of bisphenols, or currently I'm talking about BPA, but there's other compounds. And why is that? It's because it has really interesting characteristic as a plastic, because it's really, it can endure high temperature, high pressure, and it's easy to mold. So it's super interesting for a lot of products. But the problem is, yes, that compound has many characteristics as an endocrine disruptor that we're just finding out about still. The main one that is discussed is that it's a low potency estrogen. We think everybody is exposed every day of their life to this compound through many kind of products. However, the science on BPA is really complex because, like I mentioned earlier, BPA can act at probably low dose, but the way we study it in toxicology, governments find that we have not enough evidence to show that there is those effects at low dose that could lead to impact on fertility, cancer, related to anything hormonal. So it's really difficult to prove that it causes effect, but most of the science, the scientists working on that compound thinks that there is effects and we should be more active about it.
So you mentioned the possible effect that BPA has on the reproductive system. Do we have, can you just specify a little bit more, like how would that work? So it mimics estrogen, and so it's like you're getting too much estrogen in the body? Is that how this would work?
Yeah, for the case of BPA, the patterns are not clear on how it works, but let me just maybe go back on why having endocrine disruptors or something that's similar to estrogen would be bad, is that, for example, we know, like I'm not even in human health most of the time, but we think, for example, that young girls have their menstruation earlier in life because they're exposed to estrogenic substances earlier in life. So it start off the menstruation sooner than previously. And also men are usually not exposed to a lot of estrogen in their life. They produce some estrogen in their body, but having those external compounds that now can act as estrogen and stimulate the estrogen receptor in the males could have impacts that are negative on reproduction.
Do we know where these estrogenic compounds are coming from? Are they coming from plastics? Are they coming from the growing use of the oral contraceptive pill, which is largely estrogen progesterone based? Like, do we know where this potential harmful effect of the estrogens are coming from? Are they these industrial exposures, or are they medication based, or are they diet based? Like, do we have any sense of what the greatest source is?
Plastic is a big one, I think, because it wraps a lot of things that we're exposed to, so food. But of course, there's a lot of other compounds than just bisphenols that we are exposed to that can have those effects. And also, it's kind of a mixture effect. So for endocrine disruptors, other kind of plasticizer, for example, phthalates can have maybe not estrogenic effect, but more anti-androgenic effect. So the mix of those two effects together is more estrogenic in a sense. I don't know if that was clear, but
yeah. So you know, we're talking about the potential impact of these chemicals on human health. And I'm guessing that properly studying this impact in humans is difficult, right? I mean, how do you find a control group that has not been exposed to these chemicals that are so ubiquitous? How do you correctly attribute these late stage effects to a continuous exposure throughout somebody's lifetime? Are there ways of doing quality studies in humans? Or are we relying mostly on, for example, animal studies, and we're sort of inferring what might be happening to human beings?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer that, since I'm more in like environmental studies. But yeah, I think it's really complex to, like, we're exposed to so many chemicals in our daily life that just to see if, is it really, for example, bisphenols that make the effects, or is it all the other things, like your, I don't know, bad habits in life, it's really difficult to determine what's causing what.
You're studying endocrine disruptors in water, correct?
Yeah.
So what is the state of our knowledge on that, and why are you concerned about the levels of endocrine disruptors that you're seeing in wastewater, for example? What does it mean that it is there?
Historically, we had more cases of maybe something happening, starting to appear in water and seeing effects in fish. So it's more easy to discriminate. Like, so if you have one big industry on a river and like the, you can see effects in fish after the industry, but not before, it's easier to correlate to the industry, the impact of endocrine disruptors. While it's maybe harder for humans that we are exposed and we cannot stop being exposed, for example, to some compounds to like discriminate from those effects. But yeah, for endocrine disruptors in wastewater, we've known for a while that the contraceptive pill that Christopher was talking about is secreted from women that take that contraceptive pill, and then secreted through urine in the wastewater, and will go then in the St. Lawrence, for example, or any type of river, and then can cause effect in fish. Because one thing that we forget is that the hormonal system is conserved among species. So fish basically have the same hormonal system. They are sensitive to estrogen, testosterone, as we are. So the estrogen found in the contraceptive pill has exactly the same effect in fish than in humans. So the thing is, they didn't really ask to have that contraceptive pill, so it will affect their reproduction and can cause big effect in those species.
Can you describe some of these effects? Like, what is happening to fish because of our use of contraceptive pills?
I've been studying it in a model of fish called the fathead minnow.
That's not very kind to the fish, a fathead minnow.
Yeah, it's called like that because the males have kind of that fat head, which is really specific to those. But what's really crazy when you study it is, like, you've been reading that, for example, fish can be feminized by being exposed to the contraceptive pill, but it's crazy to see it in person. I've exposed fathead minnow to the active compound of the contraceptive pill. And after 21 days of exposure, the males don't look like males that much anymore. They look more like females. And just on the appearance of the fish. So it's like if you were saying the same thing for a guy that was taking estrogen. So for they would start, maybe they had a beard, but that beard would disappear over time, or some other pellosity would disappear after just being exposed to a couple days of that contraceptive pill. So it's the same for fish. Other things, it will affect their behavior. They don't behave the same as a full-blown male. They will change more to a more female behavior. And so all of this, and even changes in the gonads, so all of this will, of course, reduce reproduction overall for those fish.
Have you seen messaging on the topic of endocrine disruptors that goes too far into demonizing them? Like, I'm thinking, for example, of the whole soy boy insult that some conservatives have latched on to, this idea that men aren't men anymore because we're consuming too much soy. We're also seeing in circles that are very kind of granola, where, you know, everything is an endocrine disruptor and there are chemicals everywhere, and we need to go back to quote-unquote natural products. Have you seen this kind of messaging that goes too far, or do you believe that this level of alarmism is justified?
I don't think I personally see it. I think it's the opposite. People don't care as much about like chemicals and what they're exposed to. But I don't know, maybe I'm not in the right circles.
I think you need to spend more time on Twitter. Come down the rabbit hole with us.
Yeah, maybe. But I think, yeah, I don't see it.
It's an interesting paradigm, because on the one hand, I personally think that we overreact to stuff that is probably not dangerous, and yet we are surprisingly okay with the fact that we are polluting the planet in a really, really worrisome way. And it's weird that we are both overreacting and underreacting to what is conceivably the same, like different aspects of the same problem.
Yeah, but in my, I don't know, I may be wrong on this, but I feel the public seems to ask more of a reduction in contaminants, but the government is not able to react fully to what the public would want, because they want to have hard proof based on science, but the science takes a long time to obtain. And yeah, the problem, I mean, I've seen it, and endocrine disruptors, the initiative in regulation has been around since the 1990s. And I don't think we really have any regulation on endocrine disruptors still. So I think that's the scary part for me, that we know those things, but we cannot act really upon them.
So you're saying that we don't have regulation in Canada about endocrine disrupting chemicals. Are there differences from country to country? Are there countries where there are regulations, and what do you make of them?
So currently, I would say most regulation that led to something for endocrine disruption is mostly banning substances completely. And it's like mostly based on all countries coming together. So it's mostly for example, the Stockholm Convention, for example, is more banning some specific chemicals that are persistent. So, for example, for endocrine disruptors, there's some flame retardants that have been banned, so called PBDE, but I forget the acronyms because there's too many. So that had big impacts. Also in Canada, for bisphenols, we were the leader for banning BPA in baby bottles in 2009, if I'm not mistaken. But so we ban it for baby bottles and maybe some other infant products, but for nothing else. We think the rest of our exposure is fine, but just for baby bottles, it was really important to do something. And a lot of other countries followed. But what about the rest? Like, why are we stopping just at baby bottles? And that's because all those banning of substances act about with a principle that we call the principle of precaution. So we don't have enough data, but the first data we see seems terrible, so we'll just ban it. But then we don't do anything for the rest. And I think that's a problem. So like, for example, BPA was banned just for one use, but all the other scientific evidence, we think there's not enough to say anything. So we let the industry still produce it. And even the industry currently is now changing to other bisphenols. So we have bisphenol S, bisphenol F, all the other bisphenol that are kind of similar in structure and still doing the same thing and maybe worse. But we're really late on that. So who knows how long it will take to actually have a regulation on those.
I was going to ask you about this because that is worrisome to me, which is that, you know, what tends to happen is that one agent like BPA gets demonized. Consumers demand BPA-free products. And then the market answers back by replacing BPA with a different plasticizer, like BPS, for example, that maybe isn't as well studied, could potentially be worse than BPA. But now these manufacturers can slap a BPA-free sticker on top of their products and the consumer feels like they've been listened to. Obviously, that is not a healthy way of dealing with the potential problem of endocrine disruptors. Does that worry you, this kind of, you know, cheap, easy answer from manufacturers that are made to assuage the public, but they might actually be simply displacing the problem?
Yeah, for me, it worries me. And I think everybody in toxicology is kind of tired of this. Like every time something is proven to be toxic, industry in like maybe 1 year will change compound and find a new one that does exactly the same thing. And but has no study on it, so they can use it, and it's fine. It's really a big problem in toxicology, and I think people in my field have been like saying something about it forever.
So are there any solutions that have been proposed to avoid this problem of whack-a-mole where, you know, one particular chemical gets banned, but then there's another one that's replacing it that's just the same? So how do we avoid this from a regulatory standpoint? Are there solutions that have been put forward?
So I guess there's a couple. The first one in mind is what we call grouping chemicals. So if you can prove that a compound has a similar structure than another one, you can maybe use the toxicological studies that were previously done on that first chemical and apply it to that new one. So that would remove the need to further study and prove that new compound is has the same toxic capacity. So that would help. I know it's been done in some ways. I think in Canada for phthalates, I think they tried to do that, but it's still like at the beginning of those kind of regulation. Another way that I would really think would be efficient would be to do the same as the pharmaceutical companies and also the pesticide companies. They need to prove that they need to do all the toxicological studies before being able to put a product on the market. This should be done for every kind of product. It would just make sense that before putting your compound in the world to everybody to use, to make sure that this compound is safe. I think we should start from that, and that would remove the burden on academia to prove that something is bad for everybody and put the burden on industry.
So the counter argument here would be, well, how do you show that a small but constant exposure to a particular chemical will have repercussions decades down the road? Like, it's easy to detect acute toxicity, but how do you test for the chronic stuff? Like, how would that be done?
I think there's already some standardized test that allows at least to have a subchronic idea of what a compound can do. And I agree it would be ridiculous to tell a company you should test, I don't know, a compound for years before allowing them to use it. But still, I think some kind of test could be done and could still kind of be quick to have an idea at least on the toxicity, because I'm not even sure if we do acute toxicity on most of those compounds before they're used in the world.
Knowing what you know, have your shopping habits changed? Like, do you go looking for specific things? Do you specifically avoid plastics? If you, you know, need to get water, do you look for the bottle to be in plastic or in glass, things like that? Like, how, knowing what you know, because you probably know more than the two of us in terms of any great depth, how do you shop for products?
I tried my best to avoid anything that is with plastic. So I would really like to even go to grocery stores that are like without waste. But I'm realistic, and probably most people cannot afford those type of grocery stores or even the time to go to them and prepare everything. So I try my best to avoid, but I think it's really difficult when you're really busy in life and you have other things to do than think about everything. So at the same time, yes, I know those things, but I tend to not go crazy because I could really go crazy shopping.
So are you,
when I go shopping.
So are you worried if you go and you need to buy a steak to make for dinner, the fact that it's wrapped in plastic, do you think that's a concern?
Yeah, well, the last study that I guess went through the media is kind of worried me that a lab from McGill, I think, showed that the thermal stickers that are used to labeling meats can leach BPA in the meat even through the plastic wrap.
BPS, not BPA.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Too many bisphenol. But
too many bisphenols, yeah.
That kind of worried me. But yeah, at the same time, it's not all the grocery stores that it's easy to go talk to the butcher and maybe get the things in your glass containers. I don't know. I'm sure some people do that, but it's a lot of time to take in your day to think about all of those things.
Are you worried about people who handle receipts, like cashiers, touching these receipts with their bare hands? Because these plasticizers, they're also used in these kinds of thermal papers, right?
Yeah, I've been wondering about that. I've looked a little bit into it because I was curious, and at least studies show that they are exposed to it. The thing I don't know personally is I'm not sure if the bisphenol can get through your skin. From what I understand, people are more worried about you ingesting the plastic. So it would, I guess it would depend on if the cashier would eat something with their handful of BPA just after handling a lot of receipt. But the studies seem to show that at least they were not exposed. They were exposed under the legal limits to BPA, the limits that we think are safe. So I think they should be fine, but I would say that it would be nice to probably wash their hands after their work for sure, just to make sure they don't ingest them by accident.
I wanted to share my own thoughts about the various chemicals used in manufacturing and how they've evolved over the years. And I was curious to know if it reflects how you think about these things as well. So I used to see a lot of it through the lens of chemophobia, which is that people have an irrational fear of chemicals. And I was thinking, well, I know better and these chemicals are fine. And now I have to say, I see that some of these molecules have not been properly studied and they could have long-term consequences. And I'm more of the opinion that why add this chemical in a product if it's not needed? And obviously natural products can be toxic as well. There's nothing inherently bad about synthetic chemicals, but I think that we have erred on the side of adding inadequately studied chemicals to products for the sake of convenience or aesthetics. And maybe that was a bad idea.
There are so many things I want to add on this point. But first, the thing I want to make clear is, for example, sometimes compounds are used because they need to be used. So if you think about the bisphenol in receipt, they're needed to make, because it's thermal paper, and because BPA is there, it allows the paper to change color when it's heated and then make your receipt. So if you want to change the receipt, either you do it, I don't know, by hand, or you find another chemical to do that same thing. So I think it's difficult to have the magic word and make it replaced by something else, or just remove a compound, because usually toxic compounds have a reason to be there. So I get your point on why are we exposed to that, but most of the time I think there's a reason that it's there, and we often don't know it.
I agree that a lot of these chemicals play important roles, but the point that I was making is that, you know, in some stuff, for example, we'll use perhaps a poorly studied chemical to add a color to a product that is not needed. It's just for aesthetic reasons. And then we find out years later, well, it might have some, negative impact on health. So for those kinds of, not particularly needed chemicals and products, I'm more now of the mindset of, well, why do we need them in the first place?
There was an interesting, just to take this in a bit of a digression, that's sort of the issue that happened with microplastics in soap, right? They just sort of one day decided, we're going to put these little microplastics in soap to help you exfoliate your skin. And people were like, well, we don't really need that. Soap was kind of fine before. You sort of fixed the thing that didn't need fixing. And then you got into the whole issue of, were these microplastics bad for fish, which is a whole separate discussion, given that there were some fairly like high profile retractions in the field. So, I mean, God knows where the truth is now. But yeah, it's one of those things like, you know what? We removed microplastics in soap. And you know what? It was still soap. It was still fine. It wasn't necessary in the first point.
Yeah, for sure. And also maybe to other things that you were saying, one of the in like far away in the conversation, I think one problem is that we're exposed to a lot of chemicals, and often the studies just look at one chemical at a time. But we're exposed to a lot of chemicals, and maybe those can have interaction, what we call also effects of additivity. So maybe one alone does not make anything, but multiple together at low concentration can have impact on health. And we still don't understand fully how does that work. And also the problem related to endocrine disruption is what we found is that the bigger effects happen during development. So when you're in the womb, or like for my fish that I'm studying, when they're little eggs, it's where the biggest impact of endocrine disruptors happen. But the problem is the effects you can only see later on in life. So maybe 20 years, 40 years later down the line, you'll see those impacts. So it's really difficult to study really what kind of effect those compounds can have on the long term, even at those low concentration that we're seeing.
Have you seen recommendations for people who are pregnant, for new parents who are raising infants, that specifically inform them about what their exposure to these endocrine disruptors should be? Like, are there specific concerns there, as you mentioned, because that seems to be a particularly susceptible part of life? Are there recommendations for people who find themselves in that situation?
I don't know if I've really seen at least things like that, like recommendation for new parents or upcoming parents in Canada. I know because I've worked on it, there's France that has like a big plan of action on endocrine disruptors. And one section is about informing the public and mostly new parents about what are endocrine disruption and what can they do. So they built a website that informs on the best practice, I guess, as a parent to avoid endocrine disruptors, but it's in French. So I don't know if they have an English translation. And I'm not sure I've heard other kind of website that did the same thing in the world.
So if you had all of the regulatory power in Canada vested into you, which is a lot of power, but if you had this power based on what you know, based on what you suspect, based on the state of our knowledge, what would you change about how endocrine disruptors are regulated?
Wow. such a big question.
Try not to abuse your power. You only have it for a minute.
Like, I'm studying mostly the environment. My main problem is currently we're not even looking into it. So we're monitoring a lot of things in water, but not endocrine disruptors. So that's what I'm trying to do in my project, to help government implement at least mandatory regulation on endocrine disruption, to at least know if we have a problem, where is the problem, and if there is a problem, can we actually do something about it? Currently, we're not doing that. But for every chemical, I think it's a hard one because except of using the principle of precaution I was talking about, the studies currently that are there are the best there is, but it's just the data is difficult to have for long-term effects such as endocrine disruptors, and it can take years. So I'm not sure really how we could improve regulation, except for maybe, like I mentioned earlier, grouping chemicals. But also, I think what could be nice is maybe to prevent industry to just maybe change those compounds. I think it would be easier to manage, for example, bisphenol A that we know, we learned about it, then studying new replacement compounds such as bisphenol S. Maybe we should just start managing what we know instead of always having new chemicals that we don't know anything about in the wild.
So if people from funding agencies like the FRQ are listening, we need more money to research endocrine disruptors in wastewater. You heard it first here. If people want to find you and your work online, where would they go? Are you on Twitter? Do you dance about your research on TikTok? The people want to know.
Not really, but we're trying. If you want to learn more about endocrine disruptors, I guess I'm on the student committee of the Intersectoral Center for Endocrine Disrupting Analysis. So we're trying to do a lot of work to do public outreach on endocrine disruptors. So if you want to learn more, I guess that would look at Facebook. I think we have a Twitter of that group. So to look at, yeah, that would be it.
Julie Robitaille, thank you so much for your time and for your expertise.
Thank you for having me.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
Study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy, proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at the body of evidence.